This is Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and you are listening to Focus on Community from the K2 radio station at the foot of towering mountains and on the edge of the sea in Juneau, Alaska. Tonight, we will explore the impact of mental illness as experienced by people closest to those who struggle with a mental illness. This journey of being a parent, a spouse, or a sibling of a mentally ill individual is never an easy one. There can be confusion and fear, especially at the onset of symptoms. Isolation can occur when family members feel shame or feel that no one understands what they're going through. Parents of a mentally ill child often blame themselves. The emotional exhaustion of caretaking and trying to find treatment weighs heavily on families. Swinging between hope and despair, families may watch for signs of improvement and then flounder when their loved one declines. It's really a rough road, and the health and well-being of caretakers and family members can suffer. Fortunately, in our town, Juneau, there's a new support group for families and friends of persons with mental illness. This group is co-led by Dr. Joanne Gartenberg and her husband, Dove Gartenberg. This particular support group is unique because it focuses on self-care for family members in addition to discussing the common problems they face. The Gartenberg's group is sponsored by the National Alliance for Mental Illness in Juneau. I'd like to welcome to our show this evening Dr. Joanne Gartenberg.
Thank you, Elaine. It's great to be here.
Oh, really good to see you. Joanne is a staff psychiatrist at Bartlett Regional Hospital, and as I said, she is a co-leader of the group. So thank you. Thank you so much for coming in. Joanne, you've been here just about a year. Almost exactly a year. And we've had a little bit of a rainy summer on and off. So how are you doing with the weather here?
I love it. I just... Hearing your description about us being at the base of the mountain and the edge of the sea, it's a great place to be.
It's amazing. And I know you're a Pacific Northwesterner, right?
I feel like I've come home.
I lived in Seattle for about 15 years, and to me, it's Seattle without the heavy population concentration and just more of everything, more rain, more mountains, more sea, more everything, more eagles.
I think of it as Seattle on steroids.
that's great. So, Joanne, how did you and Dove become interested in leading this support group?
Well, we actually started as participants in the support group. We have family members who suffer from mental illness, and when one of them was going through a crisis, we felt like we needed some help. And so we started attending the support group and found it really quite helpful. And once our crisis had passed, we were thinking of not continuing, and then we were asked if we would consider leading the group. So that's how we got involved.
It's kind of rare for a staff psychiatrist at Bartlett who's working all day with people with all kinds of emotional distress, to spend one evening a week. It's kind of like a bus driver's holiday. You're doing it a lot.
But I get so much out of it, too. And it's nice to see how much help you can be to people. But as you know, as a therapist, the more we give, the more we get back.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you could say the same thing about this radio show. It's a different aspect of my mental health work and as leading the support group. And it's different from the ongoing support group that has been occurring at NAMI, isn't it? Because that was an ongoing one that people could come in and go out and come in and go out.
That's true. And that's the way ours was, and that's the way we started. But we found it a little bit frustrating and a little bit disjointed, because sometimes you would have one or two people, sometimes you'd have a few more than that, and sometimes you wouldn't have any. And we decided we actually took a hiatus for a bit and thought more about what we wanted to do, and we decided we wanted to introduce it with a bit more structure and a bit more continuity. And so we did a an 8-week session in the spring. We're on break right now, and we'll start up again in July for a 4-week session. And what we've liked about this is we've asked people to make a commitment to come to as many of the sessions as they can. And therefore, you have a group that has some cohesion and some continuity, and I think it feels much safer for people also.
Also, I think psychologically, it's like that Zumba class that I keep telling myself I'm going to go to. Well, it's going to happen next week, so I can miss this week, and it's going to happen the next week after. I think with an 8-week solid class and commitment, people like me are more likely to honor that commitment and to say, this is 8 weeks, this is what I'm committing to. It's not forever.
Right.
And
right.
I can feel complete. I don't feel like I'm dropping out and sort of disappearing. I can feel complete after the 8 weeks. Now, if somebody has been in this first 8-week segment of yours or class of yours, can they repeat?
Oh, they can, and we hope that that's what happens, because the longer people are in it, they have more to then give back to the other members of the group. And we have some people now who are just dealing with this for the first time, a family member who has just become ill. And we have people who have family members who have been ill for a very long time. And it's nice to have that mix.
Yes, it is really nice to have that mix. I lead a bereavement group, a similar format of 8 weeks, and I have invited former bereavement group members to return because their grieving continues, and so they could use it, but also they are invaluable to other group members, so that's really good.
Well, that's true, and I think also what's important in this group is for people to see that you do somehow live through this. You find a way to continue to live your life in the face of the uncertainty of mental illness, and then you also have the newer members there as support for the older members when they go through a crisis, as they inevitably will.
I remember one young widow in one of my bereavement groups asking another young widow in the same group who had been, it was her second time, and she said, can you really live through this and be happy again? And the woman who had been through the group twice and had lost her husband with maybe a year and a half earlier, she said yes. And that meant more than anything I could say.
Right.
That
right.
You could survive this.
Not only survive it, but I hate to use the word thrive, because that almost sounds like you're taking advantage of a very, you know, difficult and unfortunate situation. But you can thrive, and you learn things about yourself that you might not have known you had in terms of strength and character.
Absolutely. And the value of support groups. We're only a town of 30,000, and I know for some very specialized groups it's hard to really get a quorum. And so I am so happy that NAMI is doing this. This is just fantastic. And doing the 8-week program, I think, is a very good idea, because people can then take a break themselves and start up if they wish. I think your dates are, it's a Thursday night, and you're starting July 12th.
Correct.
And it'll run every Thursday through August 2nd.
Correct.
Is that correct? And it meets from 7 to 8:15. Could you tell us where it meets?
It meets at Congregation Sukkot Shalom on Douglas.
And a lot of people don't know where that is. Could you kind of give a sense? Is it right across the bridge, or where on Douglas is it?
It is, I guess it's officially called West Juneau.
Yeah.
So you cross the bridge, you turn left towards town and take the first right up Cordova. It's a couple of blocks up.
Oh, so it's really close to downtown.
It is.
You cross over the bridge. I've actually been there many times, and it's a lovely facility. That's really, really a wonderful place to have it. Do you have a limit on the number of people who are in the group? How big is it this time?
This time it was about a dozen. And I think we felt that with the two of us co-leading it, we could probably handle 15 or 16.
Yeah.
sometimes what we do is to break it down into smaller discussion groups, groups of two or three. And while it's different than the dynamic that you have with the large group, it does add something, and people have said that they like the combination.
Yeah, yeah. Could you say something about, well, both confidentiality and since you and Dove both have family members with mental illness, I would assume it would provide the kind of safe environment where other people are going through something like what you're going through, and you don't have to worry about judgment. How does that work in the group?
Well, and that's one of the things that we start out with is the recognition that it is a place that's safe, that we try to listen to each other with open minds, open hearts, and with non-judgment. On a practical level, everyone signs NAMI's confidentiality agreement, which says what happens in the group stays in a group. We recognize Juneau is a small town, and we're going to run into each other at the grocery store and other places.
Yeah, in my therapy practice, I work with a lot of parents, specifically parents, whose children, whether the children are still at home and are underage, or they're adult children with diagnosed mental illness. And many, many a time they have told me how when they have ventured out to share something with an extended family member or a close friend, the response they get can be very devastating. From they'll be okay. This is just normal teenage stuff. When, of course, it isn't, to, my God, I wonder what could have caused that.
Right, and I think that is one of the great values of the group. In fact, someone mentioned that specifically in one of our sessions, that it's nice to have a place where you can talk about things that you might not necessarily feel comfortable talking about out there, that this seems so unusual and so out of the norm, that having other people who are going through these same out of the usual, out of the norm experiences is very comforting. And we have people in the group, of course, from all walks of life, to professionals, to people in manual labor, and mental illness or maybe even any kind of illness. It's the great equalizer. None of us are immune from this, and I think it's nice to know that we are a community that is supporting each other.
Wouldn't it be a little difficult, since you're a staff psychiatrist at Bartlett, for people not to constantly look to you for the answer?
I think one of the things we've tried to convey is that there really aren't any answers, and the only answer is being comfortable with there not being answers. And sometimes it will come up. Someone might have a question about a specific kind of treatment or a specific medication, and I'm happy to answer that. And one time this last session, we had Judge Keith Levy come in and talk about the mental health court. So we do provide some concrete resources and recommendations for people, but it's in the face of the larger picture of people developing their own character. It's about character development, really, and about developing equanimity, a sense of compassion, maybe even gratitude in the face of very, very difficult circumstances.
Well, when you and I were talking earlier before the program, you told me that you've developed an 8-week program to really deal with self-care, to help people who are inevitably going through really, really difficult stuff, and it can be catastrophic stuff, maintain their own level of wellness and mm-hmm. and even joy in life in spite of this.
Well, I would add to that, it's not just maintaining their own level of
well-being
and self-care. It's really learning how to enhance that and really looking at it in terms of our own personal and psychological growth, Because I really believe that out of crisis does come growth, and that's certainly been my experience in dealing with my family members and mm-hmm. and other difficulties in my own life. They've only served to make me, I believe, a better, a stronger person. And that's really what we're trying to focus on in the group, not just self-care in terms of make sure you get enough rest and eat well, and those things are important too, but really how can you take what some might call a tragedy or crisis and turn it into an impetus for growth and your own personal development?
Well, it's a real paradigm shift, and I share that with you, that attitude with you, actually in the bereavement group, because when I begin, I say this is all going to be about grieving your loss and learning to live your life more fully and within the context of that loss. And I'll mention a disclaimer. Joanne and I are conducting or just finished an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program at Bartlett Hospital, which will be starting up again next September. And we take that same point of view, that stress is how we respond to outward events. Stress is not inherently in the act itself that occurs to you. And so it sounds like in your group, what you're working on is looking at our own attitudes about what's going on. And actually what you're doing is sort of counter to maybe what mainstream people would think, because I remember a friend of mine one day saying to me, and she meant this sincerely, and she's two pretty healthy kids. She said, a mother's only as happy as her least happy child.
Yeah, and my response to that is that poor child, because I think we have a responsibility as parents, as family members, to In a sense, rise above that, to transcend what's happening, and we're the people that have to be the strength for our family members, and sometimes perhaps a model of healthy behavior and healthy responses to stress.
Yeah, and your work is really on psychological self-care, which means how to take what life has given you and to respond to it in the healthiest, most life-affirming way. Is there some model you're using for that?
Well, yes, since our tradition is, our faith is Jewish. My husband is a rabbi. He's actually the rabbi at Sukkot Shalom. We're teaching it from that perspective, and there's a tradition in Judaism called Musar, which really has to do with character refinement. And I'm sure you'd find the same thing in most any religious tradition. Buddhism comes to mind when you talk about attributes or qualities. And so we're teaching it from that perspective, but it's certainly something that I believe are universal truths.
And could you go a little more into what aspects of Musar that you would be incorporating in your group?
Well, some of the character traits or qualities that we have talked about have included gratitude, equanimity, patience, generosity. I think there's a list of about 18, at least in the approach we're using, and so therefore you're not going to get it all in 8 weeks, and we hope people will continue.
So you're really delving into, you take one quality per session and really delve into it?
Basically, we do, and we introduce the quality and talk about what it means, because sometimes it doesn't mean what we think it means. You know, patience doesn't mean just sitting and waiting for something to happen. Patience means being okay with what is happening or what isn't happening. And so we introduce the quality, and then we ask people as they go through their next week and have their interactions either with their family members and just the world in general, to keep this character trait in mind, this quality in mind, in terms of how does How does this show up? Do you need more? Do you need more work in this regard? Or how is that helping you? And then when they come back to the group the next week, when we have our open group discussion, again, we ask people to keep that attribute in mind to talk about how that colored their week.
Well, you know, this is very interesting because some of my clients who have a mentally ill family member talk about the roller coaster they're on, up and down. Like I said earlier, you know, hoping for remission versus crashing if the person crashes. And what I work with is on looking at equanimity, and that's almost a foreign concept. I think child-rearing beliefs today often, you know, we've heard the term helicopter parenting. And so there may be, at least in the child development literature, I've noticed an increase in comments on we're raising a generation of narcissists, and which is ironic simply because the most well-meaning parent who protects their child from every negative experience, if they don't get along with the teacher, the parent goes in and dresses down the teacher rather than look at what's going on. That if we do too much for our children, if we're too over-identified mm-hmm. with our children, if we're too involved with everything they do and we let them determine what the family does, we may not be doing them, and we are not doing mm-hmm. them the least bit of a favor. So then what happens when you have a very impaired child in the family, whether the child is young or an adult? The same problem can occur, which is the belief that I don't have a right to be happy if my child is depressed.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. And all of these issues show up, and I think they're certainly magnified when you have a child, especially, who's mentally ill. Because then how much is too much? When do you stop hovering? Sometimes you need to hover, but you need to hover in the right direction. And again, what we're saying is we don't have all the answers. There's not a rule book for this.
Yes.
There's not an instruction manual, though we wish there would be.
Uh-huh.
But how do we maintain our sense of self, our sense of order, our sense of balance in the face of not having answers?
And really the inability to control another person's life and to control their destiny.
But isn't that something we need to learn in any aspect
Absolutely. Of life? Absolutely. I mean, I think raising, having a family member who's mentally ill can definitely be a metaphor for learning when to let go in all circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I'd just like to mention, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and tonight with me in the studio is Dr. Joanne Gartenberg, a staff psychiatrist at Bartlett, and the co-leader of an 8-week support group for families and friends of persons suffering from mental illness. So we're just going to have a little music break. Thank you, John. And here we are back. I'm Elaine Schroeder, and with me tonight is Dr. Joanne Gartenberg, who works as a psychiatrist at Bartlett Hospital. And we are talking about an 8-week support group for families and friends of people who are suffering from mental illness that is co-led by Joanne and her husband, Dove. So, Joanne, let's go back to some of these qualities of Musar you were talking about. I would, you know, when you were going through some of the list of qualities, what struck me really was equanimity because of that roller coaster ride that parents may be on with an impaired adult or young child. So how does equanimity fit in?
Well, the way equanimity is defined in this a tradition, if you will, is the ability to rise above the good and the bad. And it, that's a little counterintuitive because why would we want to rise above the good? But again, it has to do with keeping an even keel, having a sense of ourself that transcends whatever is happening. And again, having family members that are mentally ill, what you learn is, I mean, yes, you can enjoy when they're doing well, but the more attached you are to that aspect or that outcome, the more trouble then you're going to have when something bad happens. So it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy when they're doing well. Sure, you can, but you don't want to get, I guess, overly consumed by it. And
well, it's
that,
the attachment issue.
Right, right. Exactly.
So if you're attached, you can enjoy a good party, but if you need parties all the time and you expect every party to be good, you're going to be in for a lot of unhappiness. So if your family member is having some good days or having some success in their life, it would be holding on to the expectation that this should go on forever.
Right, and that the only way you're going to be okay or that they're going to be okay is that things continue to go well, where the reality is they're not going to go well all the time, but we can still have a sense of a contentment and satisfaction, even if it's not necessarily what we want to see happening.
Well, you know, when I've worked with people with impaired family members, either through substance abuse or mental illness, and in my own family, when we've approached those issues, I found there's another level of feeling okay, and that is, I feel okay because I made a good stab at it. I did the best I could with what I have. And I know I personally have had that experience where people would think, well, why would she feel okay when the intervention she tried didn't work? I feel okay because I felt I pulled off the intervention fairly well, and I have no control over whether it works or doesn't work.
Right, and I think you know that you did the right thing regardless of the outcome. And,
yeah.
And I think that's really, really important to know. When people ask, you know, what can we do for our family members? What should we be doing? And, I mean, the answer is pretty simple. It's, you know, love them, listen to them, be compassionate, keep the lines of communication open. Does that mean they're always going to do what you want them to do or take their medicine or comply with treatment? No. And does it mean even if they do all those things, they're going to be mentally healthy? Not necessarily. But it certainly is a much better choice than shutting down the lines of communication, cutting them off.
Well, I find with it's usually I'm working with the parents of children who are mentally ill, and these would be adult children generally.
And that's really right now what most of our group is made up of, interestingly enough, is parents of young adults who are suffering from a mental illness at the time when you really expect them to be having increased autonomy, increased independence. And then here you have this struggle of, again, how much do I let them go?
And some mental illness may appear during the late teen years, early adult years. But also, I think one of the reasons why both of us have that bubble of time where it's parents of young adults who are mentally ill, those are the folks who come in to see me, is because after the support of the family should be released, which would right about high school graduation, the young person may have fared better in a structured environment. And then when they're chronologically supposed to be on their own, it gets a lot tougher because they have a right to refuse treatment. They have a right to refuse anything, refuse care. They may end up on the streets, which is, of course, a parent's nightmare. One of the things I find is that it's that non-attachment to outcome aspect that is hardest. A lot of times people will think that there's, if they just found the right, and I'm going to use the word intervention, which would be an action, either keeping the kid at home, telling the kid he can't live at home, allowing the adult to not work or saying the adult has to work, having a condition of living at home that they go into treatment or not having that condition. A lot of us, because we're in a scientific world where we think that if we know what to, we should know what to do to make it work. What I explain is that we do the best we can. We try to research what might be the best possibility for this individual, but we have no control over the outcome.
Well, that's true, and I'm smiling as you say that because I'm thinking both as my about my experience as a family member, but also my experience as a psychiatrist. And I have a whole armamentarium of medication available to me to dispense to patients, to prescribe for patients, and what works for one person doesn't work for another person, and what works for one person at one time doesn't work for them at another time. So you don't have this sense of if A then B, if I do this, this is going to happen, and it really has it requires you know, flexibility and constant monitoring and readjusting to what the situation happens to be at the time.
And not to define that if intervention A didn't work, that, oh, it should have been intervention B. Or intervention A was a mistake. We shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. What I say is we've got to look at the possibility that there is no intervention that's going to work. And that isn't to be negative about it, but it is, again, it's holding on to the non-attachment. We do the best we can.
Well, and I think it also depends on how you define work and intervention working, because it may take away certain symptoms but not touch others. It may take away symptoms but not take away or not change certain attributes of their life or decisions or things that have happened as a result of having a mental illness. So I may have somebody suffering from depression and they have lost a relationship or a job. I can give them perhaps the correct medication to treat the depression, but I can't undo what has happened in their life as a result of the depression. I can help them go on from here. And again, I think that's what we're doing as family members, is we can't undo what has happened or what the illness is, but we can help our family members go on from here in the best way possible.
I think one of the things that my clients, the parents, scratch their heads about most and really suffer over is the decision whether or not the adult child with depression or other mental illness should remain living at home, whether they're doing more harm than good. And, their fear that if they don't ask the child to leave, the child who's no longer a child, the adult child, will be infantilized, and never get a job and never move into the real world. Or if they do tell the young adult that they need to get their own housing and get a job, that the young adult may commit suicide or end up on the streets. Is that a theme in your groups at all?
It certainly is. It's a constant theme. And again, what we say is we don't have the answers. We're trying to give you the tools to be able to figure out the answers for yourself, for your particular situation. It's not one size fits all, and there may not be a right or a wrong answer. There's just the best answer that you come up with.
And then not to feel guilty over the results. Do you find guilt, a sense of responsibility for a child's mental illness, is it an issue with family members?
Oh,
parents, particularly.
Of course, of course. And I think even those of us who have relatively healthy children, you know, we take so much responsibility for how they turned out. And it's great when they turn out well, because I always tell one of our children, you make me look like such a great parent. But when I step back, I realize that's mostly her and just sort of the way she came into the world, and I did my best not to mess her up too badly.
Uh-huh.
But again, by the same token, if you have a child who's really struggling and you feel that it's your responsibility what the outcome is going to be, then you are going to feel guilty. You're going to question every decision you ever made about, you know, when you introduce solid foods and whether you breastfed or not, and how you did their toilet training.
Yeah.
And I think fortunately in psychiatry, we have gotten away from these theories that blames the parents for mental mm-hmm. illness and psychiatric difficulties. Fortunately, we're much more sophisticated than that. But again, I think it's just human nature. You look for an explanation.
Right.
And if the explanation is I did something wrong, therefore, I maybe I can fix it by doing something right from this point on.
Yes. Yes. Well, I would think that would be a function that a support group could provide more so than one-on-one counseling. Because it's one thing for the clinician to tell the patient, no, this is an organic issue, this is not caused by environment or child rearing. And it's another thing to sit around and to be able to hear other parents, people you respect, people you know were adequate parents, who have a mentally ill adult child.
Right, right.
And you'd never blame them.
Right.
Never, never, never.
And that's actually one aspect of being in a small town that I think is positive in this, because what we have found in the group, people kind of show up randomly and they're sitting next to somebody that they know from another situation in a business dealing or perhaps from their church or
yes.
their community. And it's like, whoa, you're here too? I thought you had it all together.
Sounds like an AA meeting. You're here too? I didn't know you were an alcoholic. That's wonderful. And that's a wonderful part of the support group. I think you may be with people listening tonight. I hope... Please spread the word. If you know of friends or family members who would be appropriate for this group, give them a call and tell them about the group that's starting in July. July, what do we say, 13th?
I think so. Second Thursday in July.
Yes, but give them a call because this could be a real lifesaver. And yeah.
And I just wanted to clarify that the July group is only going to run for 4 weeks. We figured it would be hard to do an 8-week run in the summer because, of course, people are out doing other things. The weather's beautiful and people are traveling and so forth. So this one's going to be, we call it our intercession. We're just going to have a short
4-week
session.
Okay.
And then we'll take a break. We haven't yet set the dates for the fall, but we'll come back again and do another lengthier session.
And Joanne, I noticed on the NAMI website that there is another group that's occurring on a regular basis, a different group that's on an ongoing family basis. From the website, it looked like there was another one that was meeting, I'm trying to remember where, in a different place. Have they supplanted that group with your group?
Well, there's actually a couple of groups that are for the clients or the patients suffering from mental illness themselves, a bipolar support group, one for men and one for women.
I think they just haven't taken the other one off the
website.
I think
that's true.
That's all.
And we used to meet a little earlier, but it was the same evening, it was Thursdays, but... Again, we found moving it later in the evening gave people a chance to get home from work, get their dinner, and come in and be able to participate in this more fully.
Yes, yeah. You were talking about the qualities in Musar, and we've examined equanimity quite a bit. Another one you've told me about is humility. That's kind of an interesting, it surprised me, humility, and I'm interested to understand how the quality of humility would be of use to family members with a person who's mentally ill.
Mm-hmm. And I can see why you'd struggle with it, because I think traditionally we think about humility as meaning, oh, I need to feel meek, I need to feel humble. But that's not really what humility means. And actually in our the book that we have been taking a lot of our information from, which is called Everyday Holiness, he defines, or his description of humility is to occupy a rightful space, neither too much nor too little. Focus neither on your own virtues nor on the faults of others. So it really has to do with finding the right middle ground. And sometimes we have to occupy more space, and we might occupy more space in one situation in our life and less space in another situation. And a thought that comes to mind is that when our family member was acutely ill, my husband really had to intervene in a large way and occupy more space than he typically would occupy. And he had to travel out of town. He had to take care of some business affairs for our family member, and actually end up changing his living situation and so on. But then once he recovered and was back on his own feet, then we had to back away, occupy less space, let him make his own decisions about his treatment and where he was going to live and so forth. So again, if we kind of have this idea that, you know, we're responsible, then we're not being humble enough, but or having enough humility. But on the other hand, if we're kind of sitting back and just waiting to see what happens and giving them all the space they need or say they want, then we aren't occupying enough space, and we're not stepping in and stepping up to the plate as a parent or a family member, mm-hmm. in the way that we need to at that particular point in time.
And, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you explained that perspective, because what I was thinking is the another take on humility, and I don't know if this is included in the Musar approach, but just the humility to know that we do not control the fates of other people, let alone ourselves. I mean, there's a certain amount, it's the old serenity prayer, there's a certain amount we can do, and to understand, have the wisdom to know what we can do and what we can't do.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
With adults, and I've had many, an adult, a parent, say about the actions of an adult mentally ill child that they wish they could make them go to therapy. Isn't it crazy, they think, that they can't force them into inpatient treatment? Well, we'll talk to the ACLU about that, but I explain, no, it's not crazy. There's a whole human rights issue there. But the truth is, the way the laws are and the way reality is, even if you force somebody, when I see clients, I don't see people who are forced to come in, because it doesn't work.
Right, right. I think there has to be some sense of needing or wanting something from you, and some belief that that's going to help them.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed, Joanne, because I do a lot of couple counseling, is that when you have an impaired family member, an adult child who's impaired, or a younger child who's got learning disability, something severe, it can really cause stress in the marriage. And I remember an old figure, I think, of parents who have had lost a child through death, an infant or little older child, the rate of divorce is really high because of the stress on that marriage. What do you notice in these groups about people? What happens to a marriage?
Well, again, that depends on the couple, but some couples can navigate these waters much more easily than others and come out with a stronger relationship. I think that is the case with my husband and I, fortunately. At this point, we've learned things about each other in dealing with a family member that has made us value and respect the other person. But there are couples who are really struggling. And again, I think that's one of the benefits from the group, with this emphasis on psychological self-care and personal growth, that what we're teaching will enhance that relationship, hopefully, if you will let it. But it certainly is a struggle for a lot of couples. They might have differing ideas about what should be done. Like you were talking about a family member or an adult child, and gosh, do we kick them out on the street or do we keep them home? And you know, oftentimes the members of the couple don't agree as to the best approach.
And what we talk about sometimes in my work with couples in that situation is we don't know what would be the right thing to do. We're going to try to do the right thing, but your unity is the right thing.
That's right, and I'm thinking about Susan Chapman was recently in town, and she talked about mindful communication, especially for couples, and she talked about the necessity to move from a me-first model to a we-first model of communication. And that's one of the things we talk about in the group, the need to approach this as a couple. You might not always agree, but can you find some middle ground? Can you agree on a compromise approach?
And you know what I think happens, too? It's like you have a bad day at the office and you come home and kick the dog. When you're working with impaired child, it's really hard. And it's really easy if you don't have good psychological self-care to get into fights with your spouse. And I think just on an absolute common sense level, it'd be like working with economic difficulties. Well, you know, if somebody loses their job, it's stressful on the marriage. Mm-hmm. If somebody has a severe illness, it's stressful on the marriage. I think this is particularly stressful because there's so much sadness, so much grieving.
And again, I think any time we encounter something that's out of our control, we look for somebody to blame. So oftentimes our spouse is the most likely target. If you had only done this, this, and this, or if you would only do this, this, and this, then we wouldn't be in this difficulty. And again, what we're talking about developing is the ability to tolerate difficult circumstances, different difficult feeling states. And I'm just remembering one group that we had when we were first getting started, and it was about, I think, the third group, and it was particularly challenging. Several people in the group had just had a tough week, and there was so much suffering in the room, and I really found myself overwhelmed and wanting to be able to do something different. And I remember thinking when it was time to end the discussion and talk about the character trait for the week, I'm thinking, don't we have anything else to give these people except for another quality, another attribute? But I remembered later on that week that that's exactly what we need to be doing. And what I need to be is okay with the suffering.
You know, Joanne, don't you think that one of the fine balance is to grieve the loss? What you've lost is, if you have a child with a diagnosable mental illness that may be intractable, you're grieving the loss of a healthy child. On the other hand, you're holding out hope that this child could get better. Now, with some diagnoses, there is little hope. With others, such as depression, there can be hope. So I find that to be able to grieve in the moment, this is how it is, and this is sad. It's a type of acceptance. When you call it grief, It's a kind of acceptance. And I think, well, someone could say, I don't want to grieve because I'm holding out hope. It's like having a son or daughter who was, you know, in the Vietnam War, MIA, missing in action. How do you grieve if you don't know if they're alive or not?
Well, but I think what you can grieve is expectations that you had about how things were going to turn out that aren't turning out that way. So again, you're not saying, okay, this is the way that it is or is always going to be, but what you're saying is, I'm really sad that things, you know, my son went off to school and ended up having to come home because he had an acute episode of a mental illness.
Right.
You can grieve that.
Right, right. I remember the mother of a child with Down syndrome told me this story. And she said, she had read this, and I think it was Ann Landers, but it meant a lot to her, and I loved it, that when she was pregnant, she was expecting to have a certain outcome from this pregnancy, and she called it like going to Paris. She was going to deliver this baby, and she'd be in Paris like all the other mothers, and it would just be wonderful and giggly and laughy and full of all the developmental milestones. But after she gave birth, and it was obvious the baby was Down syndrome, she realized she was in Holland. And I don't know why Holland, but she decided she was in Holland. She was in another country. And she said it had its own flowers. It had its own quality, but it wasn't Paris. And she was shocked not to be in Paris. And she had to learn to be in Holland. And maybe that's some, you know, you make that movement. And I think your group would help people make that transition over to the expectation of a normal, successful child that you would dream of versus the journey you're on now. It's a very different journey.
Well, again, I think what it is, and I think that woman said it very well, it's really about acknowledging where we are. And we can't accept it. We can't come to terms with it if we can't acknowledge it. And so for her to even be able to say, oh, it feels like another country and there are flowers here, I think sometimes when you have a child or a family member with a mental illness, it doesn't feel like another country. It feels like another planet, and it feels like a very dark, barren planet.
Yes.
Planet. And I think it takes a lot to get to the point of saying, no, maybe I'm still on this planet, and this still is my life, and my life will go on.
Yes, yeah. And I just wanted to briefly mention before we wind up tonight the financial issues. That must be extremely stressful for parents because we don't have a national health care program. I know I've spent a lot of time in France, and I have French friends. And, of course, if you had a mentally ill child or that adult child, all their services would be completely taken care of. So I actually have a girlfriend with a child with Down syndrome, and that child's care is taken care of literally from cradle to grave. So one major fear is removed, which would be bankruptcy, because treatment is expensive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that always is a concern, and resources are different for different people. They're different in different places, and I'm just learning what's available here in Juneau and what's available in Alaska, and I wish I had specifics to tell people, but again, I don't, and I'm trying to figure it out with them. But what we try to do is point people in the right direction of getting the right resources. You know, we do have, I think, a great mental health system here in Juneau, and lots of resources for people. And NAMI has been a terrific resource in letting us develop this support group and developing support groups for the clients themselves. So I think we have a lot going for us for being such a tiny, tiny community.
And I know your support group is free. Are the support groups for clients free as well?
Everything through NAMI is free.
Isn't that amazing? Oh, well, and thank you and Dove for volunteering your time to do this group, because there's a tremendous, let me just mention, as somebody who gives groups, and there's a lot of preparation that goes into it, and you and Dove are doing a great community service. What I'd like to do is go through the details of the next group.
Sure.
Again, so that people can get a pencil out and jot it down. Don't forget, if there's anybody you think that would benefit from this group, please share this information. And the group starts on July 12th.
Thursday, July 12th.
And through August 2nd, which we made a mistake before. It is 4 weeks, and it meets Thursday from 7 to 8:15 at
Congregation Sukkot Shalom in West Juneau.
In West Juneau. And the way you register is you call NAMI. You can go on their website and get more information. It's NAMIA, or National Association for, I had it before, National Alliance for Mental Illness in Juneau. And Katie, what's Katie's?
Katie Chapman, who's
she's wonderful.
She
yeah.
is. She's delightful.
And I had her on this program, you know, many months ago to talk about the support group. But I really felt this one was so unique that we needed to go into more detail about it. So you can call Katie at 463-4251. 463-4251. And if you go on the NAMI website, NAMI Juneau website, you'll see a description of Dove and Joanne Gartenberg's program, because they've got it online now. I check that out. So what I'd like to do now is thank everybody who's been part of this work tonight. And we're all volunteers, you know, and so are our listeners. So first of all, I really want to thank our listeners for tuning in to K2. And I want to thank Joanne Gartenberg, Dr. Joanne Gartenberg, for taking the time to be on our show tonight. And to John Kramers, who's sitting right next to me and who was really willing to come in good weather and bad, usually with his wife Dolly, but today he's on his own, and they are masters at managing the board or the technical side of this show. So I will be back next month with the same program with a different guest, and we'll be talking about topics concerning all things psychological. Good night. Good night, Joanne.
Good night. Thanks so much, Elaine.
You're welcome.